This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello, how's your day? Good to have you along for this hour as we make our way around Western Australia, checking in with news headlines, a look at the weather at 12:30. A miracle birth in the Great Southern to tell you about too. And a new report looking at the effect of climate change, this time on our oceans and honing in on the effect it'll have on our fishing industries. That's to come before news headlines at 12:30. And after two terms and almost 12 years on the board of Australia's biggest agricultural cooperative, Rod Madden says his current term on the CBH board is going to be his last. The Moroa farmer says CBH has made some shocking investment decisions over the years, but he's now comfortable to step down because he believes CBH is focused on its core business of storage, handling and marketing of grain. Rod Madden says the biggest challenge during his time on the board was reaching a unanimous position on CBH's cooperative structure.
When I first joined the board, there was only two directors with that view, and that was Wally Newman and myself, and it was pretty tough going. And about 8 years or 9 years after I joined, of course, we had that big rally and communications, education with the growers. I'm reasonably confident now that we've got a really good structure in place and that the members will stand by it. It's the only way to go, in my opinion.
This announcement that you won't seek re-election might surprise some people, Rod, because there were rumours that at one point you had your eye on the chair role. Was that ever your ambition?
No, I've never had my eye on the chair role. That's a fairly big job, a rather large task. It's a good position to be, just to be a director.
You've had two stints on the CBH board. Mm. You would have seen some fundamental changes within CBH during those times. What would you say has improved for the better and what still needs to be improved?
We've at last agreed that we do have a core business and it's storage and handling and marketing of growers' grain, and that the logistics pathway to port and beyond is absolutely fundamental to the success of CBH. When I first joined the board, they were more inclined to be involved in investing because the then CEO and board decided that there was no future in storing and handling grain, and they had to go out and invest in a whole heap of investments in order to try and make money to keep the business afloat. Fortunately for now, that position's changed. So that's the greatest change, I think, that I've seen on the board, a focus back onto our core business.
And what would you like to see improve?
I think communicating with the growers is one key aspect that we've got to do better. It seems to be, to me, to be one-way pathway, and that is from the head office and from the board down to the members, rather than the coalface coming back up. So I really would like to see communications from the members back to the board and back to management being listened to, and with a more conciliatory action rather than a condescending one that we have in the past been involved in.
Would you say you've seen a cultural change within CBH since the appointment of Jimmy Wilson as CEO?
Yeah, every time you change the CEO, you change the culture of the organisation, but ultimately the board sets the culture. It's the board's responsibility to ensure that the culture is the appropriate one for the organisation, regardless what it is. And on occasions, it's been quite a condescending sort of a culture that we've been in control of, and it hasn't always worked in the best interests of the members.
And speaking of change, would you agree, or do you think there's been a change in the way CBH recruits or hires personnel in terms of who is appointed to roles and their backgrounds? Do you think that's shifted as well?
We appoint the company secretary and the CEO and then set policy and guidelines, and it's up to then to the CEO to ensure that work is carried out. And it's a case of nose in, fingers out. Sometimes we don't like what the CEO does, but if that's his way of doing things, then we've just got to grin and bear it. And if the consequences are good, then well and good. And if they're bad, then we have to look around for somebody else, I guess, to take over.
I just wanted to return that to the point that you made at the start of our conversation, where you said that CBH is back to focusing on its core business, which is storage, handling and marketing of grain. Yet the investments that were made continue to be in the system. We've got the fertiliser investment, flour mills. And flour mills, you've never really been a fan of, Rod. I think we've had conversations about them in the past, but we've just seen $43 million be loaned to Interflour. I imagine that you had some pretty robust conversations about that.
Yeah, it's been fairly colourful. There's been a bit of red and a bit of black and a bit of blue. I think the black is the good decisions, the red are the bad ones, and the blue is the conversation that we have in the meantime. But that's an historical issue. The majority of the board, I think, bar Wally, inherited the flour mills, and we've got to try and make them work. You mentioned fertiliser. That is as close to our core as you could get. The fertiliser, is it running okay? We've certainly lowered the price of fertiliser and achieved better terms for the growers. That's closer to the core than flour mills by a long way. We've inherited some of those investments, and some we've had to bed down the or get exit out of. The Lupin Food Australia was one. Futura shares were a disaster. We had to get out of them. And since I was on the board, Newcastle Agri Terminal was a shocking decision. Probably trying to get out of that as best as we can, but we have refocused back onto our core.
So what should happen to those flour mills?
I can't discuss that with you. That's a confidential issue for the board. It's not my place to discuss that with you. That's more a chairman-type issue. I'm sure that
you
Wally
can't share your opinion on it.
That.
On it, Rod, is what you're saying there, because I know you have one, but you can't share it with us.
Well, you've got that right.
I guess we get a sense of it anyway. Morawa farmer Rod Madden, whose current term on the CBH board will be his last. It comes to an end at the next CBH annual general meeting, which will be held early next year. And Rod Madden talking to Joe Prendergast. 12 past 12 here on the Country Hour. What do you make of that too, Rod Madden's point, that if there was one area or one room for improvement area, he's identified that being communications, and he believes that really needs to be improved going forward. And there has been in the past that sort of condescending attitude from sort of board and management to the growers. Do you believe that is the area of improvement that really CBH needs to work on going forward? Or is there something else you'd like to see CBH work on? Let me know this afternoon. 0448 922 604 to text through your thoughts this afternoon. On the Country Hour, 13 past 12. And still on the state's main grain handler, because it has plans to expand its fertiliser business to command a 25% of the total WA market, a share of 25% of that WA market. Now, CBH entered the fertiliser business back in 2015 and currently has a 6.5% share. So that's a 110,000-tonne share of a 1.8 million-tonne WA fertiliser market. It imports its fertiliser from the Middle East, China, and occasionally from Germany. David Pritchard is the CBH Fertiliser Business Manager. David, what are your plans for expansion?
Like any new business, we're expanding and wanting to expand. So currently we're looking at options in Kwinana to – we currently lease our facilities, so we're looking at options whether we keep leasing or perhaps build a warehouse. What we do know is we need a larger facility in Kwinana to facilitate our expansion plans. Ideally, we end up in Albany and Esperance as well, but that's, you know, that's a 2 to 5 year plan to flesh all that out.
So that's quite an investment, by the sounds of things, with that sort of infrastructure that you're needing. What's sort of been set aside, or in terms of the dollars that need to be spent to sort of bring that plan to reality?
Nothing is yet. We're still in really early days of planning to work out which way we go, whether it's renting, continue to rent or to build. So nothing's been set aside. So we're really just in planning phase at this stage.
Is that storage facilities? Is that what you're specifically talking about?
We're looking at storage facilities for fertiliser. Absolutely.
What other infrastructure do you need around that to make it possible?
Not a lot, really. It's just we need a purpose-built fertiliser warehouse that's highly efficient, run with as little staff as possible. So not dissimilar to a grain storage warehouse, if you like, but with segregations inside and some blending machinery. So relatively straightforward sort of a warehouse.
Okay. And how much could that store then? How much fertiliser could you hold in that?
Oh, look, in Kwinana, we'd be aiming for 45 to 50,000 tonnes of storage. And if we're talking about in the regions, 10 to 15,000 tonnes at a time in say, Esperance and Albany. So that'll just give us some benefits on shipping into multiple ports and operational efficiency.
We just heard from Rod Madden, who's going to be stepping down from the board after so many years. I think it's about 11, 12 years or so. He's been one of the directors. And he was talking about fertiliser. He was saying that really, it's as close to the core business of CBH as you can get without actually being the core business, which is the storage, handling and marketing of grain. Are you really confident that this is the right move since it is just to the side of the core business of CBH?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, we're not looking to take over the total market here. We've got to strike the right balance between the risk we want to take on and delivering the right outcome to the growers, which is the end game here, is keeping them competitive. And fertiliser is 20 to 25% of their inputs. So we think we can really sort of have an influence there on their cost base, which at the end of the day is going to keep them competitive in a global market. So it's not our core business, clearly. That's storage and handling, always will be. Fertiliser will always be little brother off to the side.
Yeah, and you said, what is it, about 6% of the WA market share you've got at the moment? What's the aim there as far as the market share goes?
Market share, anywhere from 15 to 25%. That's an aspirational target. That will take some time to get to those numbers. It's not as easy as turning it on tomorrow. So that's a 3 to 5 year plan, those numbers.
Yeah, okay. What about, you're mentioning there, you know, it's one of the key inputs for a grain growers anywhere really is this, the fertiliser input. But it's not something that you can really control the price of, is it? I mean, that's sort of an international market forces at work there that really determines that. So depending on what's going on internationally, that could skyrocket.
Yeah, it is like any commodity. They're all tricky to manage. So we've got to strike the right balance between how much we want to take on, how much we can get sold to growers, and really relying on growers to give us support here, which will de-risk the business for us. But there's no question it comes with risk, and we've got to strike the right balance between that.
How confident are you that you'll get that grower support?
Pretty confident. Yeah, I mean, it's been 4 years to date, and it's growing every year. We've got to respect growers. Have got relationships with incumbent fertiliser suppliers, but I think growers are starting to get some real confidence in this, in our ability to manage this profitably this year. And I think we'll, you know, slowly but surely. It's as I say, it's not an overnight aspiration here. So we're confident that growers will warm to this business venture.
And what's the first step in this, David? I said, you know, you mentioned earlier there's a couple of different things that could possibly happen over the next 3 to 5 years, but what's the definite next step in this plan?
Next step for us is what we're currently doing is assessing the best option at a planning phase. So we're in infancy stages of planning out what's the next step, whether we build, whether we lease, and where we do it and how we do it. So as I say, we're in planning phase. We're in that step now. And that's going to take some time to flesh that out, what's the right option.
David, good to have you on the Country Hour today. Thank you.
Thanks, Belinda.
David Pritchard, he's CBH Fertilisers Business Manager, and just talking about how the grain handler has plans to expand its fertiliser business, which it got into back in 2015, currently has a 6.5% share of the WA market, but hoping to increase that perhaps over the next 3 or 5 years to command a 25% share of the total WA fertiliser market. 20 past 12. Well, meanwhile, interestingly, New Zealand-based dairy cooperative Fonterra has decided to get back to basics focusing on its core business and shedding a range of assets. Fonterra has posted a net loss of $605 million for July this year, which is slightly better than expected after asset write-downs of $826 million. The company says it will now focus on New Zealand and New Zealand dairy farmers, and that's raised questions about the Australian arm of Fonterra and how that now fits into the broader business. Here's Fonterra CEO Miles Hurrell.
The good news, as we've already touched on, is that we've made significant progress on our three-point plan and our financial discipline. As part of taking stock of the business, we reviewed our asset portfolio and made significant calls on three assets we identified as no longer core to the co-op. We sold Tip Top for $380 million, and we announced yesterday we sold our 50% share in DFE Pharma for $633 million. We also wound back our relationship with Beamate and have now started to reduce our financial stake in this company. Taking stock of the business didn't stop there. We also kicked off a strategic review of our wholly owned farms in China, exited Venezuela, and closed our Dennington manufacturing site in Australia. This sort of discipline around reviewing our asset portfolio is not a one-off. We're continuously reviewing our assets and making sure they are meeting the changing needs of our co-op into the future. The strategic direction that we have chosen brings New Zealand to the fore, but that doesn't mean that is going to be the extent of our business. The strategy for us is around where you put your incremental last dollar, if you like, and where you'll be spending your money and time and effort to grow into the future. That simply doesn't mean an exit of our existing businesses. We'll continue to look at places like Australia to ensure that they can stand on their own two feet as an operation, but we have no plans at this point to exit the Australian operation.
Fonterra CEO Miles Hurrell, 22 past 12.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Sterile Queensland fruit flies are being released for the first time over fruit-growing areas in New South Wales and Victoria. Now, fruit flies, they're a serious pest, and on top of the damage they cause to produce, it's estimated they cost the Australian horticulture industry $300 million in lost market access. Now, the man overseeing this first trial of sterile flies, native to Australia, is Phil Taylor. He's from Macquarie University, where he's director of the ARC Centre for Fruit Fly Biosecurity.
Court Innovation, in particular, has invested heavily in developing this new approach, the sterile insect technique. So we have a factory now. It's in Port Augusta in South Australia, where they can produce tens of millions of flies each week. Those flies are then sterilised and shipped to rear out centres. We have one at the moment in Tatura and one in Yanco in New South Wales, where an aircraft comes in and picks them up when they're ready to be released and flies them out over release areas to get those flies into the wild populations. Now, those flies are sterile, and any female fly in nature that mates with one of those flies will fail to reproduce. And so by this way, we can reduce the wild populations, the pest populations, without any use of insecticides and more invasive techniques. So this is something that's safe to use in production areas, it's safe to use in townships, and is a very sustainable means of managing this terrible pest.
What exact areas are where the flies are being released?
So this season, we're focusing on two major areas in New South Wales and in Victoria. So in Victoria, we're focusing on Cobram, and in New South Wales, in Helston and some surrounding areas. We're comparing the number of flies that we're catching in those places where we're releasing the flies and comparing the number of wild-type flies we're catching in those areas through the season with some areas where we're not releasing the flies, just so we can demonstrate that this is an effective tool. So basically, we have an aircraft with a chilled release device in it, and so the adult flies get packaged up and chilled and put in these bins that get dropped into an aircraft. The aircraft flies around at about 200 metres up above the townships and above the production areas that we're working with. And there's an auger that just slowly drips flies out the back of the plane as it goes. Yeah, the flies have a dye on them, and so we can identify our sterile flies that we're releasing really easily. And each week we rotate the dyes so that we can, you know, we can understand the persistence of the flies in the field, how well they're doing and how well they're dispersing. And we can identify each week's releases I really keep close track of how the program is going, how the fly is surviving in the field, and monitoring it very closely.
Do you have other sites in mind, Phil, for future trials if these two work well?
Not at the stage. It depends on funding. So it depends on the engagement of industry and interest. But we're using these at the moment as demonstration areas, so we can really illustrate the effectiveness of it. And over the coming 2 or 3 years, this program will transition into a commercial or quasi-commercial operation, and so the flies will become available for broader application, and we'll start to look for other sites to do that.
Now, some of our listeners might think programs like this could be carried out across the country to eliminate the fruit fly problem completely. Is that a reality down the track?
It's difficult in this case. Now, if we're talking about the Mediterranean fruit fly in Western Australia, I would say, yeah, absolutely, we can go ahead and eradicate it. It's not a native species. Queensland fruit fly is a native species. What we're focusing on at the moment is areas where it's not native to those areas naturally. And so particularly the major southern growing areas that we're focusing on protecting at the moment, and really protecting the fruit fly free status of South Australia and Tasmania as well. Those are important priorities because that gives us real advantages in market access. If we really do this well, I think we can roll back some of the problems with the fruit flies in Victoria, New South Wales as well, and maybe even reclaim some of those fruit fly free areas that have been lost in Victoria and New South Wales. We can't eradicate Queensland fruit fly nationally, but we certainly can do a lot to protect those production areas.
Professor Phil Taylor from the Centre for Fruit Fly Biosecurity, talking to Tony Briscoe about the release of millions of sterile fruit fly into growing regions in New South Wales and Victoria. Now, we have had a sterile insect trial running in Western Australia, and it concentrated on the medfly in Carnarvon. It ran for 4 years and it wrapped up in June. Full eradication wasn't achieved, but the Carnarvon Research Station will now work with the growers to focus on best practice and also on property management of the medfly. 27 past 12, and just before we get an update from the newsroom, the world's fisheries will struggle to deal with more acidic waters and more frequent marine heat waves due to climate change unless emissions are curbed. That's according to the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which looks at the world's oceans. Lucas Forbes with this report.
The latest IPCC report warns of rising water levels, melting ice sheets, and ecosystems struggling to adapt to the changing climate. Australian Marine Conservation Society campaign manager Tuni Mato says climate change isn't a future problem, but a current one.
Well, Australian fisheries are already feeling the effects of climate change. You know, we're seeing this right here, right now. A great example, or a terrible example, whichever way you look at it, is off the coast of Tasmania, where we've seen a decline of around 95% of Tasmania's kelp forests over the past few decades. And that's had really severe knock-on impacts on the abalone and rock lobster fishery, particularly with the incoming of an invasive species of sea urchin that's come down with warming waters from the north.
The Society wants to see more marine conservation areas and less fishing to help species adapt to climate change. But Ms. Mato admits even that won't prevent the worst effects.
These are sticking plaster measures on a broken leg. Unless you actually address the underlying cause of climate change, then no amount of good fisheries management or marine sanctuaries is actually going to protect the ocean ecosystems or the industries that depend on them. But, you know, things like marine sanctuaries and well-managed marine parks and good fisheries management give our species and therefore the industries that depend on them the best chance in an ever-changing climate.
Seafood Industry Australia CEO Jane Lovell says locking off Australian waters to fishing isn't the way to go at all.
One of the things that's really important to understand about the Australian seafood industry is that we have a high level of science. We do a lot of management and monitoring of our fish stocks, and what we can take from the ocean is adjusted based on the biomass, so the number of fish that are out there. Now, you know, that kind of scientifically rigorous approach to making sure that we can continue to provide sustainable protein source to Australians and, you know, for export is absolutely critical to the future of this world.
South Australian commercial fisherman David Wilkes says he's worried about the effects of climate change, but he thinks there are other environmental problems that are more pressing.
As a commercial fisherman, I definitely do have concerns with climate change and global warming and rising sea levels and that sort of thing, as most people do. But I believe the more pressing issues regarding commercial fishing at the moment are things like effective management, the pollution issue, toxins and plastics going directly into the ocean. I believe that they're things that we can address and have a real impact on immediately.
Commercial fisherman David Wilkes ending that report from Lucas Forbes. And stay with us because, whatever you call it, climate change, climate variability, parts of Western Australia are very warm and dry at the moment. And just after the weather, taking you to Cookeran, where some dams are empty and we haven't even got through spring yet. That's to come here on The Country Hour. First, though, Sandra Shimanberg in the studio with the news headlines.
Thanks, Belle. Synergy has posted a net loss of $657 million due to what it calls ongoing challenges in a complex environment. The company's revenue fell 4.7% from last financial year to $2.8 $4 billion. A Southwest man has pleaded guilty over a deadly altercation outside a Bunbury night spot in May. 56-year-old Danny Talbot received serious head injuries following the incident and later died in hospital. In the Bunbury Magistrates Court today, Joshua Ainsley Kelly pleaded guilty to unlawful assault resulting in death. A new institute to study and propagate kindness has opened in the US state of California. The institute at the University of California in Los Angeles is believed to be the first academic-based research institution to focus on kindness. And in the AFL, Richmond assistant coach Justin Lepage says there'll be one change to the Tigers' side for Saturday's AFL Grand Final against Greater Western Sydney. He says Jack Ross, Camden McIntosh and Marlon Pickett are in contention to replace the injured Jack Graham. Belle, I'll be back at 1 o'clock with a full bulletin.
Thank you very much for that, Sandra. It is 28 to 1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Barischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Great to have you along this afternoon. Before the news at 1 today, that miracle birth I was telling you about happened in the Great Southern, taking you there to the farm just to check on things, see how they're going, and also Mount Barker Cattle Market. The details for you right before that news bulletin at 1 o'clock. Tracy Kilner going through that for you. It's off to the Weather Bureau now, and Noel Pusey is with you. Noel, where do you want to start today?
Oh, Tasmania? No, West Australia, that's right. Okay. Anywhere you like. I'm going to start in the north and say for the next 4 days. It's clear conditions through there. We had a little bit of a burst of some pre-season thunderstorm activity through the Kimberley over the last day or two. Oh, well, last 3 or 4 days, but it's eased off now. It's very dry. It looks like we'll continue that way for the next 4 days. High pressure ridge in the south is the dominating feature at the moment. There is a very weak front that's pushing through the southeast corner of the state today. Maybe some very light showers this afternoon through our southern parts of the Great Southern and the adjacent south coastal district, and maybe in the southwest district in the south. But very light falls, and it's not going to penetrate really to main agricultural areas there, so remaining dry through that area there. As the remnants of the front slip away, we would do see a little bit of thunderstorm activity develop overnight through the goldfields and possibly the southeast coastal district, but more likely through to the Eucla in the overnight morning period during tomorrow morning, and then it looks like it will actually continue into Friday night and Saturday as well over those eastern districts there. But just isolated thunderstorm activity, mainly the lightning strikes might be the main thing out of that. Some fairly light falls expected rainfall-wise, but mostly in the Eucla and southern goldfields, but perhaps into the far eastern parts of the southeast coastal district on early Friday morning before it moves further east. Otherwise, the ridge in the south is the main feature. It remains to the south for the remaining forecast period. Gradually a trough develops near the west coast during Saturday and Sunday. Temperatures warming up slightly near the west coast with that, but the trough remains inactive. So dry conditions right through, generally northeasterly winds are becoming more northerly during Monday as the trough starts to move a little bit further east ahead of a weak cold front out to the southwest. That front doesn't actually make it to the coast at all, but we look at relatively dry conditions through to at least probably Tuesday at this stage for the agricultural areas and the southern half of the state.
Any hope beyond that of some rain, Noel?
Well, there's a reasonable front possible at this stage into Wednesday. It's really Thursday into Friday, perhaps, but we'll wait and see how things develop there. It's the spring pattern at the moment, a relatively quiet spring pattern followed by fairly dramatic sort of changes in the longer term, and things take a while to settle down before we're actually too certain on it. But I think perhaps at the end of next week might look better for some rainfall.
All right, then. And warnings this afternoon?
There are no warnings current at the moment, Linda.
Thank you for the wrap. Appreciate that. Noel Pusey with the details today. And it's 25-1. On the rain front, in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, there hasn't been anything over 5 mils right across Western Australia. In fact, the highest total was at Jarrahdale. That's in the lower west region. And it had a total of 3 mils in the gauge.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
And Mick just sent this text through. 8 millimetres at my place at Denmark since 9 o'clock this morning. I think I'm reading that right. So since 9 o'clock this morning, that's why it hasn't registered. So that'll be there. I can repeat that for you right here on the Country Hour tomorrow, Mick. Thank you for that. 24-1. And speaking of the conditions, the warm and dry spring, it's certainly causing a few problems for farmers here in Western Australia's grain belt. For example, agronomist Kim Gooding says farms in the Corcoran area, about 300 kilometres southeast of Perth, could really do with a drink.
So after a late break across the state, which we experienced as well, things were looking pretty good. Yeah, we're looking at a reasonable year until spring came along, and yeah, now we're fighting the elements of heat and obviously in the last couple of weeks a little bit of frost here and there. So yeah, it's all down to the lap of the gods now. If they can bring another rain for us, it could still be okay, but the forecast doesn't look all that promising in the short term. If we could jag another rain, and it doesn't have to be that much, then we could still be average to slightly below average, which we'd be quite happy with given where the grain prices are at the moment.
Has the heat and the dry conditions meant that farmers are cutting hay earlier?
Probably about a week in front of where we'd normally like to be. So the crops have been, particularly the guys who are doing export hay, the crops have been forced along somewhat. Nothing's been cut down for any frost damage, thankfully. Obviously a fair bit happening down in the Esperance region. At the moment, it's mainly just the export hay guys chopping everything down now. And yeah, I'd probably say we're about a week in front of where we'd like to be.
So how are those earlier crops going if we rule out rainfall for the rest of spring? Yeah. How are the yields looking for the earlier sown crops?
That is the million-dollar question. The earlier crops, in all honesty, given where the rest of the state's at, trying to be a little bit sensitive about it, the earlier crops still look quite good, particularly the barley. It's going to come down to how those earlier crops finish. I'm a little bit concerned about the later crops if we don't get a finish. But yeah, some of the earlier barley crops are filling out quite nicely now. It's really going to come down to what moisture is left below as to how well they're going to fill. If it's going to be lightweight grain or pinched off grain, we're still confident that there'll be markets for the grain given the shortage across Australia. So yeah, we'll take some lightweight grain given where the prices could potentially be.
Given those warmer, dry conditions we're experiencing this spring, how are pasture paddocks hanging on?
Surprisingly well. We've finally seen a little bit of clover. It's only taken all year to finally see it, and here we are, we're about to knock it on the head. So it's hanging in. It's really starting to feel the pinch now, but we'll get in there and spray top now, and that'll probably be the end of that, and it'll just turn into some good quality dry feed, we hope.
Kim Gooding, he's an agronomist at Corcoran Rural Services with Olivia Garnett. And he says they normally start harvesting about November 10, but if they don't get any more rain, Kim thinks farmers might start towards the end of October. 21-1. Well, we're only just coming out of winter, really, but a lot of farms in the Corcoran area are so dry at the moment. That's not good if you have livestock. And that includes yabbies. Mary Nenke's yabby farm dams are dry, and so she hasn't been able to fill orders. She says this has been her driest season in decades and worst year for her business.
You know, in 28 years of doing yabbies, we've had a week at a time where we've had no yabbies to supply our customers, and that's devastating. You know, we've got so many fabulous customers we've developed over the years, and it's really terrible when you can't supply.
Does that come down to water, to full dams? What is the reason behind that?
You said it in one word, water. Yabbies need water. They need air and they need food. But if they have no water, we have no yabbies. You know, they die. So it's been the driest summer that we've remembered, really. We had 19 dams dry on our property. The boys have actually cleaned out 15 dams. And, you know, there's so many other farmers across the regions that are in the similar situation. So it's been quite critical. We're very thankful to the farmers that have made the efforts to bring us in yabbies to keep the markets open. And, of course, we're always looking for more, and the demand is huge. You know, when we first started, the Chinese market, for instance, didn't exist. Even Chinese restaurants didn't want yabbies, and now their demand is huge. So, yes.
What other markets are your biggest customers?
Generally, our markets these days, that we're selling more in Australia than we are overseas, simply because we haven't got the volumes. I mean, last year we were sending shipments of 600 kilos at a time to China. This year we're really looking after Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, and a little bit here in WA.
So if you had the volumes, you could expand how much further?
Oh, enormously. I mean, our facilities are designed to handle about 4 tonne a week if needed. We have actually done 4.1 tonne in 1 week. We'd probably be happy to do 2 tonne a week. That would be fantastic. That'd be quite comfortable. There are markets out there really seeking our yabbies.
So now we're spring. Your purging tanks are behind us. How many yabbies are around now?
As you saw, there's very little in there, Olivia. It's really distressing. As soon as we get yabbies, they're shipped. Well, once they're purged, sorted individually and purged, they're shipped out. We've got clients ringing us daily. We've got new people contacting us every week, saying, you know, I've got an event, I would love to put yabbies on. Because I think the big thing is people have really learnt what a delicious crustacean they are, and, you know, they're really in demand.
So if water is a problem, have you considered taking advantage of the government subsidies to help with building water resources on farms?
Look, we were very excited to see those grants available last summer. But when I investigated, it didn't fit WA very well at all. Very much designed for the East Coast, you know, where they have bores and they can put new bores down, etc. And also designed for you to employ somebody else to increase your water supply. So, you know, we actually went out and we bought a loader so we could clean our own dams out. And we just couldn't have resourced that if we'd had to pay somebody to do it. But we don't qualify for government funds. And I actually raised the issue with politicians that it really does need looking at is, you know, how can we help people improve their own water supplies in Western Australia?
Cooker and Yabby farmer Mary Nenke with Olivia Garnett. 17-1. We'll get the results of the Mount Barker cattle market for you shortly. Just before that, some live export news for you. About 3,000 head of cattle will be on their way from Port Hedland to Indonesia tomorrow. This will be the second live ex ship to leave the port this year. And that's significant because Port Hedland has been trying to rebuild its live cattle export trade since it started back up in 2017. Hedland Export Depot Director Paul Brown says the cattle have been sourced from across the Pilbara and Gascoyne, and despite the ongoing dry conditions, the stock are in pretty good nick.
We started, I think first draft was 1st or 2nd or 3rd of February this year, so normally you can sort of not start until, you know, April or May or way after Easter. So it's just reflective of that the season has a pretty ordinary wet season right across the board. So people just saw the light nice and early and wanted to move cattle just to take some pressure off, you know, and that includes getting rid of, you know, cows, surplus cows, just anything that they could get a price on it and move at any particular time. You know, the meatworks here and the meatworks south are sort of on record numbers too. A lot of cattle have gone to meatworks and
you know, they're getting rid of a lot of these older cows that always come into problems. And I do note that there's a boat obviously going out of Port Hedland in the next few days, which is terrific for those guys down there. But, I think we've got one, possibly maybe two more here out of Broome, and that'll be just about us for the season too.
And our price is still holding up at the moment, Andrew?
Yeah, I think so. Again, we've been very, very fortunate. So we're selling cattle. Normally you get a drought and the market's pretty difficult and all the rest of it. No, the market's held up all year and it's still holding up, but I think some pressures might come on as we get closer to Christmas.
So do you think that given that the season started earlier, there has been this huge turnoff of cattle, what are the effects going to be later in the season or next season?
Yeah, it's hard to say, like, really. People have still obviously got their breeders. The whole idea is getting calves off cows to make it easier. Water is going to be the big issue. It's still been reasonably cool, although the last week or so has obviously started to warm up. But, you know, as it gets hotter, water is becoming a real issue. And, you know, all the old timers out there are saying that water holes and whatnot and dams are drying up that they haven't seen dried for a while. So I think everyone was just getting prepared for the fact that, you know, this whole climatic change across the whole of Australia is dry, dry, dry. And then the forecast from anybody that, you know, people looking at different websites trying to get something a little bit more positive. But, you know, the Kimberleys is saying just on an average season, wet season coming up. So I think everybody's pulled the right reins by trying to move cattle off as quick as they can, just getting prepared for maybe a leaner season.
You're driving around the Pilbara at the moment. I mean, just on the ground, what is it looking like out there? Is it looking pretty dry?
Oh, yeah, look, it's dry everywhere, mate. Like, I've sort of cover a fair span. But, yeah, it is exceptionally dry. Take your pick anywhere north of the 26th parallel, you know. And, again, it just shows that it's not in just in one isolated area, which also makes it difficult for the store market. Generally, there's somewhere good somewhere or somewhere that you can move cattle, whereas the challenge has been this year that there's been nowhere exceptionally well that you can send cattle.
And that obviously isn't the Port Hedland Export Depot Director, Paul Brown. That is, in fact, Landmark's Broome livestock agent, Andrew Stewart, catching up with Courtney Fowler. And just talking about how dry it's been over the last 12 months or so, the audio seems to have skipped a bit. So we missed out on hearing from Paul Brown, but obviously pretty excited about that shipment going out of Port Hedland tomorrow. Our figures released by the Department of Primary Industries indicate that live exports are up by 66% across the Kimberley and Pilbara this year. And there's been a 59% increase in cattle sent south for processing. Again, another indication of just how dry it's been. 13 to 1 here on the Country Hour. And I'll be very interested to find out if you have heard of this happening before. A horse in Western Australia's Great Southern region has just given birth to twin foals. And so far, both have survived. And I'm told that is very rare. It's quite common for sheep and cows to successfully deliver twins, but the odds of twin foals surviving are about 1 in 10,000. And the odds of them surviving past 2 weeks are even higher. Daniel Mercer's been to the stud in Wagen to see how the miracle foals are faring.
I'm surprised, very surprised. I have had a breeder in Wagen that I've done this to twice because the chances of both surviving was considered almost zero. So this is an exceptional occurrence.
That's John Maxwell. He's been an equine vet for more than 50 years. The foals were born on Kevin Spurr's property. He owns Spurr's Stud.
She enjoys a bit of a rub and a pat, doesn't she?
My first thought was, God, don't tell me another mare's had a foal and it's run away and left that one. And then a bit after that, I realised that she'd had twins. And it's just, we were a little bit stunned, actually. I didn't know what to think, and it was a big shock. It wasn't expected.
So you had no idea that she was pregnant with twins, with twin foals, obviously?
No, I didn't. What would happen sometimes, if you sent your mare to the vets to get AI'd from a stallion or whatever, they check that they're in foal, and they do recommend to double check again to make sure that they haven't got twins, because it's not natural for a mare to have twins. They're not set up for it. Their body's not designed for it. But I just run a simple operation here. I have my own stallion and mares, and so I put my mares and hand serve them with the stallion. And if they don't come back into season, I'm pretty sure that they're right. Some of them I'll take away and get them preg tested, but you know, it's cost to everything, and I just thought, I'm just happy if they get in foal. I know they're in foal. The chances of having twins, I didn't even think about it, really. I know that there is a small chance, but not very big at all.
So when you realise that the mare had twins and that they'd both survived, what's your thought process then?
It's a tough call. I think instantly there you've got to make your mind up as what you're going to do. Some would say common sense would be to do away with the twins, to bang them on the head, so to speak, because the chances of anything being good after that are pretty slim. There's the very highly likelihood of that they will die, or one will die. There's a big cost involved with getting to the vets and everything else. So had to weigh that up, and then you see these little buggers fighting for their lives. So yeah, I just thought, hang on, well, look, we'll make a decision here. We'll get them to the vets and we'll see if we can save them. So we had to let them out every 2 hours. And so, yeah, I think at the moment, you know, Nikki's at 8 o'clock and I'm at 10 o'clock. She's at midnight, then I'm at 2 o'clock, and then she's at 4 o'clock and I'm at 6 o'clock, and then we've got daylight. And then so just the night time's been a little bit tough, you know, that alarm goes off and you think, oh, God, I don't really, you know, I want to stay in bed. But you know that they're waiting for you when you get out there. They can hear them whinnying and carrying on, and out they go like little rockets and straight onto mum. And
if they can survive to adulthood, what sort of prospects do they have, and what do you imagine you might be able to do with them?
Look, there's nothing wrong with the breeding side of things, so all the genetics are still in place, and I thought, well, that carries some weight as well, especially the bigger one has probably a better chance, because the small one is very small. Yeah, so really I'm looking at a chance there that I can use them for breeding purposes.
And Kevin, I mean, I know that you run essentially a commercial operation here, but how hard is it to close your heart to what, you know, is essentially the miracle of life when you see such a rare circumstance like that?
It just changes a lot of things, you know. Really, when you, like I say, when you see something fighting for its life, there's a tendency to want to help.
Years ago, we had a lot of horses here, and we had a lot of horse breeding here. So in that time, I would have seen and diagnosed twins, not regularly, but it wasn't uncommon. Now it's very uncommon.
In your experience, have you ever seen or known of two to be born and survive?
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
So would you say these two little ones up in Wagen are very much against the odds?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And it'll be interesting to see if they survive.
Equine vet John Maxwell with Daniel Mercer, and talking about just how rare it is for twin foals to survive. You also heard from the stud owner, Kevin Spur, and there is a story for you online if you'd like to have a look through that. And there is, which is something definitely worth having a look at, a really gorgeous video so you can check out the foals for yourself. And there is a link to it on the ABC Rural Facebook page. The video is on the Facebook page, so you can see it there. The foals' names are Snip and Drop. And an interesting side note to the story is that Mum only has one eye. See if you can guess her name. So many comments. I think it's nearly 400 comments gathered underneath the story and the video of the foals, and many along the lines of, you know, how gorgeous, wishing you all the best, things like that. And this one from Julie: good luck with them. Many months of hard work ahead. In 2001, my mare had twins. Yes, she was scanned twice and missed them. The long hours, vet costs, but you have to give them every chance. Teams of friends worked around the clock for months. The highs and the lows, risks of infection, pneumonia, special casts on the colt's legs, but we didn't give up. Wishing you all the very best. As I said, the foals are now 2 weeks old. They do look good in the video. Have a look for yourself on the ABC Rural Facebook page. It is 5 minutes to one.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Eleanor Hall. On the program today, what's going to happen to the globe's highly populated coastal areas as climate change takes hold? We talk to one of the world's leading experts about the latest scientific evidence.
The rate of warming we're seeing in the ocean is a massive amount of energy you're pumping into that system. It raises sea levels, it melts ice, it intensifies tropical cyclones. There's payback, if you like.
The warning that Australia's ageing electricity infrastructure can't cope with renewable energy, and quantum supremacy. Are we entering a new era of computers with limitless power?
More than the headlines, The World Today.
Five to one, so The World Today, not too far away. News first at one, and then The World Today. To the markets now, and there was a cattle sale at Mount Barker today. 1,389 head sold. That's up about 500 head on last week's market. Tracy Kilner's there now. Tracy, what were the prices like?
Prices fluctuated with quality, with the young steers gaining on all categories with increased demand from feeder buyers. Young heifers lifted, with live export buyers picking up all suitable lines. The medium weight weaner steers topped the market at $3.36, closely followed by medium weight yearling steers at $3.34 a kilo. The heavy prime cows sold to a top of $2.26 to finish down 2 cents overall, while the prime heavy bulls eased as well, topping at $2.28 a kilo. Grown steers weighing between 400 and 500 kilos sold for $2.40 to $2.72 to average $2.65 a kilo. Heifers over 540 kilos eased, selling for $2.06 to $2.38, while the lighter weight grown heifers made from $1.80 to $2.46 a kilo. Yearling steers sold from $2.50 to $3.34 for the best to average $3.09. Heifers, yearling heifers made from $2.00 to $2.84 to average $2.56 a kilo. Weaner steers sold for $2.70 to $3.36, averaging $3.23, while the weaner heifers returned $1.70 to $2.78 to average $2.34 a kilo. Heavy prime cows eased slightly, selling from $1.85 to $2.26 to average $2.11 a kilo, while the store cows sold for $1.30 to $1.52. Prime heavy bulls eased 7 cents, making from $1.92 to $2.28 to average $2.11. Medium weight bulls sold for $1.94 to $2.20, and the lightweight bullies made from $2.20 to $2.99 a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you very much for that, Tracy. And that wraps up our livestock markets for this week. We will check out the wool market tomorrow, round about this time on the country. I'll just see how the market's been after 2 weeks of, well, heading in the right direction from a grower's perspective anyway, heading north after quite a long run of prices going down. I think about a 6 week run before things turned around. So we'll check in with the wool market this time tomorrow. Just repeating the lead story from today. After two terms and almost 12 years on the board of Australia's biggest agricultural cooperative, Rod Madden is saying that this current term on the CBH board is going to be his last. And that will be, and it's always available online for you, but the best way to listen back, if you do have the coverage, that is to download the ABC Listen app. And you can kind of go back and listen to any of the ABC programs for that matter. But you can just, once you have the app on your phone, you can just do a search for the Western Australian Country Hour, and then you can find which show you're after. So if you want to have a listen back to that interview, you can do that later today. And also, just after catching up with Rod Madden, we spoke to David Pritchard, who is the business manager with CBH Fertiliser, and going through the fact that the state's main grain handler now has plans to expand its fertiliser business. At the moment, the fertiliser business just has a 6.5% share of the total WA fertiliser market. It only got started in 2015, so a 6.5% share now. But the plan is, and what they're looking at the moment, is expanding that to, say, somewhere between, say, 15 and a 25% share of the total WA market. As I said, download the ABC Listen app, have it on your phone, and you can listen back to the shows whenever you like. And if you get some time, you can spend a little bit of it on the ABC Rural Facebook page. As I said, those foals, the really gorgeous video of the foals is there. But also, you'll be blown away by some of the photos of chunks of gold found in Western Australia's goldfields region recently, worth about $3.9 million at today's gold price. And this discovery was at the Beta Hunt gold mine in the goldfields. And the latest find was made by truck driver Chris Lemonos, who spotted some large chunks of visible gold while emptying 45 tonnes of rock out of his tray. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.